It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll talk to author and WPR colleague Erica Janik about the early history of Wisconsin, from the days when we were a territory, not a state, and how Independence Day might have been celebrated back then.
First, we'll kick off a new segment. It's called Curious Wisconsin. We'll help solve the little mysteries we run into from time to time in our state. And we want you to help out. If you're curious about something in Wisconsin, send your question to talk@WPR.org, and we'll try to track down someone who can answer it on an upcoming Curious Wisconsin segment.
Our first question comes from me. Every time I drive through Platteville on 151, I see this giant M on a hillside, and I've always wondered what it stands for.
And we're pretty sure it's not M for Platteville.
Right. I don't think it's monkey or miso soup. So we've got Paul Erickson, UW-Platteville's Director of University of Information and Communications, on the line with us to answer my question. Paul, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Rob and Veronica, and happy 4th of July.
Hey, happy 4th of July to you, too. So let's first solve the mystery. What does the big M stand for?
Well, in one word, it stands for mining. But to understand the M, you kind of have to know a little bit about our history.
Mm-hmm.
The current UW-Platteville has its roots in two schools, the Teachers College, which was founded in 1866, and the Mining School, established in 1908. Those two colleges merged in 1959 to form our current university. And the M then was formed by mining students 76 years ago. They started the M, they walked it out in the snow one year, and they thought it looked so cool that they the next year they made it out of rocks, and it's stood there ever since.
And those are the original rocks in the Platteville M?
They are. We've been replaced a few of them, but it's still the original configuration for the last 76 years.
Now, there was the mining school in Platteville. Was Platteville a mining area, too? Was that part of the economy?
It was. Platteville was founded as a mining town, and mining lead and zinc. And the mining school was a big part of the area until it merged with the teachers' college, like I say, in 1959.
So with the mining there, it made a lot of sense to have a big mining school in the area.
That is correct.
And now, when did mining start to taper off in your part of the state?
As a major at the university, I know it finished in about 1985. But as the mining industry went a little bit before that,
mm-hmm.
and went by the wayside. So.
And now mining isn't part of Platteville's economy now, but what I want to turn from the past now and when that M came to be to some of the things that make Platteville and the area special today.
Well, obviously the M is what makes it the most special because that's what everybody asks about it
really?
When they come in, because it is kind of funny. It's like, yeah, the M, Platteville, I don't get it. So this actually makes a really good talking point for us. It's in the middle of our university logo, and it actually is a leads to a lot of good questions about our history and a lot of chances to talk about what's going on in Platteville. But the mining major here at the university kind of morphed into our engineering. We are still a very, very strong engineering school in the state. And we have draw engineers from around the tri-state area. For those of you who don't know Platteville, we're about 20 miles from Dubuque, Iowa, and about 30 miles from the Illinois border. So actually, when you stand on top of the M, you can see all three states, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa.
And I was wondering about that. I mean, I've only seen the M from the highway. Can I actually get to it, or do I have to venture through private land and, I don't know, barbed wire and whatnot?
No, it's not armed or anything. There's no armed guards up there. They actually have steps that lead up there, and I swear they add more steps every year. Last time I climbed it, it seemed to be higher and higher, but the M stands 241 feet high. It's 214 feet wide, so there are steps and some landing areas there about halfway up where you can stop and take a breath, but it really makes a nice view that, like I say, you can see all three states from the top.
And is this a big alumni destination going back to the M? And I'm guessing the people who built the original thing kept visiting it from time to time over the years.
The M is really a source of pride at the university. Like I say, it's in our logo. We have engineering students who go out there at least once a year and whitewash the rocks. It is lit twice a year, and by lit, I mean we put kerosene containers all around it and light it at homecoming, and then again for a special remembering our miners' ball. It used to be a big tradition. So at our homecoming, then we also shoot fireworks from off the top of the M, and that draws about 1,000 people out there every year.
Now, give us a little taste of Platteville today. If I were to stop by on 151, and I've stopped by to eat, I think it was kind of on an off day. A lot of things were closed. But apart from the M, what's a must-see if I swing by Platteville on a road trip?
Well, other than the university, there's also the a mining museum where you can actually go down into one of the historic mines.
Is this one of the old lead mines?
Yes, there is. Yes. Oh. Yes, and they take you down there, and there's it's called the Rollo Jameson Museum. We just dedicated some new statues honoring veterans in the middle of City Park. We do have quite a few walking trails through the city, and it's one thing you'll notice as you go through, it is a very hilly city, so there's a lot of bike riding, a lot of different trails to explore.
All right, Paul, thank you very much. You've kicked off our Curious Wisconsin segment. Thanks for solving that mystery for me.
Okay, thank you. This was a great segment.
Thanks a lot. That was Paul Erickson with UW-Platteville.
And by the way, if you'd like to send us a picture, snap a shot of that Platteville M, which I've never seen, I'm really curious to see this Platteville M now, you can send it to talk@wpr.org and maybe stick a Platteville M in the subject line. We'd appreciate hearing from you. And what are you curious about? Email your question to talk@wpr.org and just put the words Curious Wisconsin in the subject line, and we'll try to get you an answer in a future Curious Wisconsin segment.
And speaking of being curious about Wisconsin, coming up we're going to get a taste of Wisconsin history, find out how Independence Day might have been celebrated in the Wisconsin Territory back in the early 1800s into the 1830s. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Today is the anniversary of the birth of our nation, but not our state. On July 4th, 1776, Wisconsin wasn't even a territory.
Here to break down why this day is still an important one in Wisconsin's history is Erica Janik, freelance writer, author, and producer of Wisconsin Life. Her books include A Short History of Wisconsin. Erica, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So, Erica, set the stage for us. What was going on in what is now Wisconsin on 4th of July, 1776?
Not much.
It's going to be a short interview.
That was Erica Janik.
You know, at the time, even though that Wisconsin did, you know, pass over to American control after the American Revolution, not in 1776. At the time, it was really just a bunch of native people and French fur traders here. So, you know, all this stuff that's going on in Boston about declaring our independence, all these English speakers, you know, protesting British control of them, you know, Wisconsin was pretty much full of people speaking French who were mostly looking to Montreal and to Europe for their guidance. They really could have cared less what was happening in Philadelphia and Boston.
And so nobody really was paying attention to what was going on in the Revolutionary War where we're sitting right now.
That's very true. I mean, there was probably a few people that, you know, were aware of what was going on. But really, the fur trade really dominated early Wisconsin. And that was really what the economy revolved around. That's why people were here. There wasn't a lot of white settlement in Wisconsin up until the 19th century. And so it was really just fur traders passing through. And there were some American fur traders that did start to come here. But really, even after the Revolution, the British still really controlled the fur trade here. And so, you know, Wisconsin was just kind of an afterthought even to the new American government.
Were people at least eating grilled meat then, like they are today?
Oh, I'm sure they were eating grilled meat. You know, lots of hunting and fishing as well. So definitely a big part of it.
And so when did Wisconsin become a territory?
So Wisconsin actually became a territory on another July 4th, July 4th, 1836. You do need a certain number of people in order to become a territory. And Wisconsin finally had enough settlers by 1835. Wisconsin was actually a part of the Michigan Territory at that time. And they petitioned to become their own territory. And on a very symbolic date, July 4th, 1836, Wisconsin became its own territory.
And now there were more American settlers here by then, as you mentioned. Were they celebrating the 4th of July then? And if so, what would they have done?
There was definitely some celebration. You know, you'll find people that were having kind of parades. It was usually just kind of a local feast that people were having. the parades, you know, really start kicking off more. You see mentions of them in the newspapers in about the 1840s, and it was a really big thing to have a revolutionary soldier marching in your parade, because, you know, that really tied you back to independence. And so you'll see, you know, towns promoting that they're going to have some man who fought in the revolution marching in their town parade. And actually in Madison, so, you know, once Wisconsin became a territory, the only actual real job of a territory is to pick your capital. And so once they decided that Madison was going to be the capital, they actually laid the cornerstone of that first capital in Madison on July 4th, 1837, another very symbolic date. And so kind of Independence Day that year was mostly people who were here in Madison to build that new capital were kind of celebrating with dancing and food and some singing.
And I'm guessing the food didn't include bratwurst because the German settlers, right, didn't come till probably the next decade or so.
That's right. The Germans don't really start coming until the 1840s. So there is actually a woman who lived in Madison. Her name was Rosalind Peck, and she actually left a little remembrance of that first 4th of July. And she said that they had wine, liquor, pickles, preserves, and champagne. That doesn't really sound like a complete meal
sounds
to
like
me.
Sounds like my kind of party, though.
Sounds like what you're serving tonight, Rob, doesn't it?
Except for the pickles.
Yeah, it's striking, though, isn't it, that there are all these, I mean, we didn't celebrate on the first July 4th, but there were two other Wisconsin important July 4th dates. So really, we should be celebrating in triplicate in Wisconsin on the 4th of July, right?
Definitely. You know, I think it's pretty common, not just in Wisconsin, but in lots of different places all over the country to do things on July 4th, you know, dedicating a statue, opening a new government building, just because this day is such an iconic part of American history. And so even though we couldn't be part of 1776, you know, I think Wisconsin definitely has made some symbolic gestures towards that July 4th date.
Well, another year that's locked into my head, soon after I moved to Wisconsin, Huber became my beer of choice. And their label, at least back then, always read 1848, born with the state. So I learned quickly, Wisconsin became a state in 1848. So by July 4th, 1848, a couple months before that, right? We were a state.
That's right. So Wisconsin actually becomes a state on May 29th. I guess they messed up a little bit. They didn't get July 4th that year. So May 29th, 1848. And, you know, becoming a territory is actually kind of a way station to becoming a state. You, like becoming a territory, you also need a certain number of people in order to qualify to be a state. You have to have 60,000 free people. And Wisconsin actually by 1845 had 150,000 people. So more than enough people to actually become a state. But there are actually some people who weren't sure that statehood was a very good idea. They worried that by becoming a state that their taxes would go up. And they also worried about having a centralized government. So you see, things haven't really changed very much. people had a lot of the same fears, you know, in the past as they do today. But finally, you know, people did really think that becoming a state was probably a good idea. They argued that, you know, it would bring a lot of internal improvements, things like railroads and canals. These were really important things in the 19th century to help build up your economy. And so finally, in 1846, we actually got a referendum through to move towards statehood. But it still took another 2 years before Wisconsin actually became a state.
So that's why the lag, all this controversy about centralized government and
a little bit. Wisconsin actually wrote the Constitutional Convention. They met in 1846 to draft a first constitution, and they wrote a pretty radical document. One of the things that was in that document was that they gave married women the right to own property. Now, this was extremely radical for the time period, because at that time, in most other states, women were property. They couldn't own property. They also put the idea of African-American suffrage up to a vote. There was also a lot of distrust of banks, and the first constitution actually outlawed banks. This constitution, though, was a little too radical for people, and it was eventually voted down, and they went back to the drawing board, and they drew up a new constitution, which was eventually passed. And so Wisconsin accepted this second constitution, and we became a state in 1848.
So we were pulling in all these people from 1836 to 48. What were they coming here for? What were they doing for a line of work?
Most of them were actually just farming. That agriculture was a big draw for people. There was a lot of, you know, this land of opportunity. There was a lot of just land available. You know, you find a lot of immigrants who are coming from countries where they just didn't have a lot of land that they could actually farm and the possibility of actually owning it for themselves. You do find also as you mentioned, with Platteville, a lot of mining. That was one of the main industries after the fur trade in Wisconsin. And so you do find a lot of immigrants coming to work in the mines, but the vast majority of them were really coming to own land, be farmers.
So do you have a sense of how the 4th of July celebrations evolved over time when it started to look a little bit more like it looks today?
Well, you do find, I was trying to figure out when the first fireworks displays were in Wisconsin, and I'm not really quite sure. You find fireworks displays in a lot of the big cities in the East Coast, even in the late 18th century. Congress actually authorized a fireworks display in 1777. And so that really got the idea that, fireworks and 4th of July go together. You do find mention in newspapers of, all kinds of parades and picnics, by the 1850s. And so, I think that's really common with what a lot of people are probably doing right now. They're spending the day with their family. They're out having a picnic somewhere. They're out being outside. So I think that's something that kind of comes into the 4th of July celebrations fairly early.
Now, you mentioned the idea of the territory selecting Madison as a capital. What went into that? How do they pick a capital, and why kind of southern in the state?
Bribery. That's what went into it. Bribery. So there was actually a man. His name was James Duane Doty, and he was actually a territorial governor of Wisconsin for a little bit, and he actually really helped get Wisconsin to become a territory, and he was very invested in Wisconsin. And he had actually purchased the isthmus that is Madison because he had come through here and in 1831 or so and thought it looked pretty good, and he got a good deal on the land, so he purchased the whole isthmus. And then when the territorial legislature met, their only job was to select a capital. And there were 19 contenders. There were, Milwaukee was one of them, Portage was one of them, Fond du Lac, and this town, Madison, that no one actually lived in. And James Duane Doty had actually hired a surveyor to map out this dream city of Madison. And he put out down all of the streets, and he actually named it Madison because President James Madison had just died, and he was trying to capitalize on public sympathy for this man. And then he also named the city streets after the signers of the Constitution. And so he goes to Belmont, where this territorial legislature was meeting with his big city plan. He also brought some buffalo robes with him because a lot of the legislators were complaining that the building they were meeting in was really cold. And so he was like, here, I have this big city plan. Look how amazing it looks. And I have some robes to keep you warm. And if you vote for my city, I'll give you some city lots. So basically, bribery. And after several votes, they did actually select Madison as the capital.
Not that inspiring a story, actually. I was hoping for more glory and grandeur instead of a bribery and buffalo robes. I'll take it, though. I'm glad it's Madison, I guess.
Well, it does also have a kind of, it's in a central location, too, between the two population centers of the state. So, but, every time when I give talks in Milwaukee, everyone in Milwaukee wants to know why they're not the capital of the state. So.
Yeah.
Well, move ahead a few years. Not only is this the birthday of the United States, we just had the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. What did Wisconsinites do in the Civil War?
Well, I think it's funny, when we think about the Civil War, I think Wisconsin rarely comes to mind. But actually, Wisconsin soldiers fought in every major battle of the war, including they were at Gettysburg. Gettysburg is really seen as this very pivotal battle now, this kind of the turning point of the Civil War, and it really halted all of the Confederate attempts to invade the North. A very famous brigade, the Iron Brigade, that included many Wisconsin regiments, fought at Gettysburg. They were really in the thick of the battle on the first day, and they suffered a tremendous number of casualties. The 2nd Wisconsin Infantry was actually the first to engage with the Confederates on July 1st, and they lost nearly a third of their men. And among one of the wounded in that regiment was a man named Lucius Fairchild. He actually had to have his left arm amputated, and after the war, he actually became the governor of Wisconsin. He served 3 terms. So there was, Wisconsin really did play a major part in every battle, as I said, and we're definitely right in the thick of things at Gettysburg.
And so, Erica, thank you for giving us this primer, but I got to ask you, you're a historian. Are you going to be having the Peck-style Thanksgiving feast today? Are you going to be having champagne and pickles and I don't know what else she had, frog legs?
Historically. I might. I mean, maybe. I do feel like I should pay homage to that really traditional feast. She does mention a year later that they had bacon and fish.
It's getting a little better.
At least there's a little more food in it.
They were both pickled, though.
True.
But so are the people eating them. So it all worked out.
Oh, wow. Well, there's a lot to chew on there. No pun intended. Erica, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And happy 4th.
That was Erica Janik, freelance writer, producer, and editor of Wisconsin Life. She's also the author of A Short History of Wisconsin.
And we're curious what you're doing to celebrate the 4th, something historical perhaps. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page and let us know.
Coming up next on Central Time, we'll talk to the host and producer of Wisconsin Foodie about local meats and where they come from, and some of the other things you can grill, too. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Check us out on the Central Time Facebook page and follow us on Twitter. We're Central Time WPR. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's the 4th of July, our national day to celebrate independence, freedom, and grilled meat.
But do you know where that meat comes from? Or what if you don't eat meat? What's a vegetarian to do at a barbecue today?
Well, here to answer our cookout questions are Arthur Ersink and Kyle Cherick from Wisconsin Foodie, a weekly television show about the unique culinary tradition of Wisconsin and the people behind the food.
And we want to hear from you. What are you grilling for the 4th? What grilling secrets are you willing to share just with us? Call 800-642-1234, email talk@WPR.org, or post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Arthur, Kyle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Veronica.
Nice to be here.
Well, I think, you know, it's the 4th of July. People are getting their grills on. Are people thinking these days more about where their meat is coming from, Kyle?
No question. Absolutely. Just the uptick in interest in our show and some of the topics. But I would say the American consciousness of where their food comes from in general, and particularly the proteins, fish, and then the classic, the beef and porks and things like that, has changed almost provocatively in the last 10 years. We've gone from the relationship that we used to have with the butcher, where we look somebody in the eye, and in that sense we knew where the meat come from, to this sort of disenfranchised, just buy it wrapped in plastic, oftentimes pumped up with water and salt, to now knowing the name of the farm where that cow or pig was raised.
So if that's true, what are you eating? What are you eating some form of grilled meat that you know the pedigree of today?
Well, my barbecue plans always, I mean, I'm originally a Milwaukee boy, so they include bratwurst just because there's actually a civic fine within the city if you are a meat eater and you don't have bratwurst on a national holiday. So that's definitely what I'll be having. And I like to get mine from European homemade sausage. Frankie Kupchak, who's a master sausage maker and someone that we had on the show 2 seasons ago.
And now, Arthur, you've done shows, both of you, on local butchers and meat shops around Wisconsin. They're popping up all over. What are some of your favorites?
Yeah, that's there's a great trend going on right now, whereas, you know, back, you know, 20, 30 years ago, 40, 50, 60 years ago, there's a lot of local butcher shops in every community. You know, I know in Milwaukee, for instance, there's a lot of, Serbian communities, German, Polish. There's all sorts of different communities, each with their own butcher, each with a different style. And I think over the course of the last couple of years, you've seen that disappear, and people have, you know, just resorted to going to Pick and Save or their local grocery store to buy their meat. But now I think there's a lot of a younger generation that's bringing back that tradition of the local butcher shop. So, you know, one, for instance, in Milwaukee is run by Karen Bell. It's called Bivette. And she, you know, you can go in there, you can eat lunch, and you can watch them butcher an animal right in front of you. And that's just kind of an interesting experience, and I think there's a lot of foodies out there that want that connection. And then if you go to Madison, there's Underground Meats, and these are all younger guys in their 20s and 30s that are really bringing back this tradition, and not just bringing it back, but improving it. You know, using really great locally sourced meats and techniques that they're doing, you know, in the Basque region of Spain, or you know, really unique. treatments to these products. So it's really exciting to see kind of this turnaround in events, and you see that all over the board, not just meats but cheeses and all these old school traditions are starting to come back.
It
used to be the case with, we're on the heels of, I think, probably the nation's greatest state fair. And I say that in all deference to Wisconsin, but in all seriousness, the Wisconsin State Fair is easily the best in the country. There's no question. And that's coming up. And it used to be that the prized hog and the prized cow that won the blue ribbon at those events would then essentially, it'd be a bidding war between grocers, smaller grocers all over the state, and whoever would get that animal. Then there'd be a line of people waiting to get cuts from that animal. And we have gotten away from that within the larger grocery template, but places like Bavette that Arthur just mentioned, or Underground, have really brought that back around and done such a compelling job of connecting the story for consumers without hitting them over the head, but then having the quality be worth the price, which arguably is sometimes just a scotch more.
So
people are willing to pay for flavor, there's no doubt.
Kyle, I know you're a meat eater, and Arthur, I'm going to out you, you're not a meat eater. And I'm not a red meat eater either. So Kyle, I'm going to ask you, what is the difference in taste between if I go to Pick and Save, grab a, packet of ground chuck, what have you, or go to one of these more artisanal meat places you're talking about, what's the taste difference?
Sure. Well, there's two things really that contributed, three things that contribute. Time is a huge one. Freshness and everything matters, whether it's produce, and within 72 hours it loses most of the nutritional content. It could be spinach from California or green beans from somewhere else, or blueberries from Michigan. With meat, that makes a huge difference too, regardless of whether you have it in cool temperatures and so on and so forth. So there's a texture and there's a flavor difference. But more importantly, when the animals are, we like to say treated humanely, but they're essentially happy animals, and they do what evolution designed them to do and eat the kind of things that they're designed to eat. And I want to go on the record. I'm okay with beef that is grass-fed but then finished off, is the term, in the last month on some grains, because that adds a lovely marbling flavor to that beef. But just feeding the beef, for instance, on grains the entire time would be like feeding us only entirely on bread our whole lives. Hmm. And we'd all end up looking like sumo wrestlers, which is fine if you are a sumo wrestler. But they don't sprint for a bus too quickly, I guess is my point, and do what the body is designed to do.
And even though I'm a vegetarian, I have to admit that I probably know a lot more about meat and than a lot of other, meat eaters out there, especially the flavor, even though I've, it's been 17 years since I've had a piece of beef. But, I think when cows are grazing on pasture and they're eating what they're supposed to be eating, I mean, that's the natural taste of beef. That's how beef should be. Enjoyed, and that's what they're meant to eat. And even though it's a healthier meat, it's a leaner meat, these animals are being raised properly. I mean, that's something that everybody can kind of get on board with. And there's a company that I've been working a lot with is the Strauss family, and they are pushing the industry as far as the free-raised veal. Veal for eons has been, basically tied up. I don't want to get into the details of how veal is raised, but they are doing things the proper way, and you see a lot more. Like, for instance, I'm at Uplands Cheese up in Dodgeville, right outside of Spring Green, and they, he's known for Pleasant Ridge Reserve, but he also has veal calves from his cows, and it's very limited, but you see this trend in these veal calves being raised with their mothers on pasture, and it's the humane way to do it. And just companies like this that are really taking the lead and really doing things the right way. And it's something that we should be proud of. And I think Wisconsin is a leader in that.
Well, I'm sure that all of the people who are working on this, they also are getting some sense of how best to prepare the meat as well. Do you guys have any secrets to share about how to get the most flavor? If you're, let's say, grilling, because today's a grilling day.
Everything that I know about grilling I learned from my buddy Josh Ozersky, who writes for Time and Esquire and a couple of other magazines. But he's basically put together and hosts the Woodstock of grilling and the Woodstock of meat out in New York. But his simple principles are basically, if you're going to do it at home, have the pan really, really hot. If you're grilling, basically brown the outside, pink the inside. And this goes essentially across meats with the exception of chicken. You want it to go to white and the juice to run clear. And that's how, I guess, meat connoisseurs, if we want to call ourselves that, will get the most flavor out of a terrific animal that's been raised properly. Because when a cow, as Arthur was saying, when it grazes, you know, veal or whatever, grazes on clover and timothy and alfalfa, those flavors come through in the beef. They can't help not. And you want to appreciate them.
And Arthur, real quick, you know, we don't want to leave vegetarians out of this. What's your favorite thing to grill as a vegetarian?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to be the voice for all vegetarians that may be listening today that feel a little bit left out, because, you know, there's so much more that that you can put on a grill than just meat. And I do admit, you know, when I go to a friend's house, I have a friend's, I grill at a friend's house all the time, and he's got the meat grill, and I've got my my meatless grill, and, you know,
people, your portobello grill.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's more to just that than portobellos. You know, like something I've seen a lot of chefs do lately, which is really cool, is there's a Caesar's string cheese. You know, it should be, you can find it everywhere, but it's made, you know, it's a locally made string cheese, and it's probably one of the best string cheeses you'll ever eat in your life. But if you throw that on the grill, it just, like, it melts, just like, it just gets soft enough where it's, you know, without melting, where it's just this, like, perfect little delicacy. And then, you know, you've seen people grill kale and, like, romaine lettuce, like, different lettuces on the grill. I know that sounds ridiculous, but they're just delicious when you can, you know, pull that off and cut it up and eat it. But then you can also look at I think the fake meat world, and I don't even want to say fake meat, but I'll go there. But the fake meat world has come around so greatly, where it's like we've transcended, like, Boca burgers and, you know, just like, you know, even these fake meats aren't even really good for you because there's so many ingredients. But you look at a company like Field Roast.
Yes, Field Roast.
And,
amen.
You know, Field Roast is amazing, right? They like put natural ingredients in there, and they use like a wheat gluten there's, I think even meat eaters would enjoy like eating some Field Roast brand sausages.
But
I just have to jump in and say we had lunch at Field and Fork Stefano up in Sheboygan last week, and I had the Trempolo walnut burger on purpose.
Oh, yeah.
And I loved it.
That
I mean,
is, yeah, exactly. And I think that's something we're going to talk about on the show this year, so people have that to look forward to for next season of Wisconsin Foodie.
I had that last night, and it is amazing, I have to say.
It's good.
Got to put in a plug for that.
I've taken two patties, like de-thawed them, and then like stuffed it with like an aged cheddar, and like put two patties together with an aged cheddar on the inside and, like, grilled that. And, like, the cheddar just kind of melts inside these two beautiful walnut patties. And, it's a treat. I recommend you should do that.
Well, we're talking.
Before you guys go off on some vegetarian tangent, I do have to say as a devout meat eater that I love grilled corn any time of the year. It's one of the best things that's ever basically been done between a vegetable and fire.
What
I just
about
want to
mayo?
Put that out
putting
there.
A little mayo on that? What is, like, the Mexican style?
Okay, you guys, break it up. I have to... You could go on all day, but we will go on some more. I want to hear more about this. I'm especially intrigued by this grilled string cheese. That's one I've never heard before. We're talking to Arthur Ersink and Kyle Cherik from Wisconsin Foodie about grilling, and we'd like to hear from you. What are you serving up for your 4th of July celebration? And what is your favorite thing to grill? If you're a vegetarian, we're talking about some of those things today, getting some ideas. What do you grill instead of burgers or brats? Or how do you really get the most flavor out of a hamburger or a piece of meat like we were talking about earlier? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're picking up again with Arthur Ersink and Kyle Cherik of Wisconsin Foodie. And we're also taking your calls now on what you'd like to put on the grill. And you could also share your grilling tips with us. Let us know what your favorite treatment is of a meat or maybe a vegetable on this grilling day. Maybe if you've got a favorite butcher as well, we'd love to hear why and how that flavor might pop differently to you. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we've got a comment on Facebook says, listening online in Nashville where it's raining, so no grilling, but I love grilling vegetables. And yes, vegetarians can grill too. And I think, Kyle, you were waxing rhapsodic about corn right before the break. What do you love about corn?
Well, sweet corn is just such a, I mean, it's such an amazingly delicate, right now the 4th of July is really when it's in season through September, and when you've had a great rainy, the two rainy season like we had here in Wisconsin, the corn is just growing, you know, leaps and bounds, and it's just so tasty, and it's something that has been cultivated basically since the 1700s into something that is high in sugar content, grows in those great thick rows, and soak it in water, throw it into a campfire if you can, even within the husks, or, you know, strip it down and put it on a grill and turn it a few times. It's even the most ardent dilettante in cooking, you know, someone who makes a mean tray of ice cubes can manage grilling corn, and with great Wisconsin butter and a little bit of salt, it's just, it's sublime.
What do you think is better, grilling it in the husks or peeling them off?
You know, it depends on the situation. I mean, we were just camping and we did it in the husks in the campfire, and then actually kept some the next morning for the sort of huevos rancheros that we made, and carved some of that corn off, and it was just so fantastic. I kind of prefer a grill just because it's a little bit more immediate, and I hate to admit that within the society I love, you know, some immediate gratification, but with a fantastic New Glarus beer and a little bit of salt and butter, I'm good. You could probably leave me, you know, in the middle of a riot and I'd be happy.
Now, Arthur, you were talking earlier, you started off with string cheese and then you mentioned grilling kale and lettuce, which, you know, don't strike me as the most grillable foods, but I guess that's starting to happen now. How do you do that?
Well, I think, you know, I recently had a thing of romaine lettuce, and you basically, you just keep that, you keep it all together, and you put the whole, you know, you can cut it in half or you can put the whole thing right on the grill. And it just gives it this nice, like, smoky kind of char flavor to that gets into the lettuce. And it wilts a little bit, and it's just a little soft, and it's so delicious. But I want to get back to the corn thing. So we you know, if you cut it, you know, if you take that corn, and then, like, I don't know if you guys have ever had that, basically the Mexican corn, but they basically cut it in half, and after they grill it, and then they slather it with basically mayonnaise and queso fresco, the crumbly cheese, and maybe a little hot sauce. That is like the best treat you could ever wish for. And I'm hungry for it now. That's why I want to keep talking about it, because I need to get some for myself.
Seen that recipe, putting mayonnaise on corn, and I can't get past the mayo on corn thing. So it's actually good?
Oh, yeah. It's great.
Well, Veronica, if you think about it, mayonnaise is really just eggs and dairy. I mean, that's essentially, those are the bases for it. And most Americans are used to buying Hellmann's and things like that, but... you know, I mean, actually, Hellmann's has done a really great job talking about where our food comes from, of at least getting cage-free eggs to use in their mayonnaise. And
right.
So, I mean, it's pretty rudimentary things that you're putting on there, and then that queso fresco cheese. Shazam.
Yeah, I can't go wrong with cheese on just about anything. What about squeezing some lime over that corn?
Oh, yeah, I think that's the way they do it. I think I may have left that step out, because I'm not a chef. I'm only a consumer, so... But I think they may put a little cilantro on there as well, and just kind of and a little lime, and I think that is we just gave your listeners a little treat to make.
I think everyone's thinking corn right now. It sounds pretty good.
There might not be a lot of corn going on right now, so.
And so, Kyle, you know, we talked about brats. You're going to be eating brats today because you have to legally in Milwaukee. And
yeah.
We talked about, I think, burgers pretty much. But what about some other less popular kinds of meat that you might be grilling? What do you suggest if you want to get a little jiggy with your meat?
Well, I'm a big fan of both trout, and we've got rushing water. We've got rushing waters. We've got an amazing Wisconsin resource. And I'm lucky basically throughout Milwaukee or Madison, I can buy their trout at any good grocer. And, you know, trout doesn't need much. I mean, basically it's filleted and just a little bit of seasoning, some rosemary and some other things on the inside, olive oil, throw it on the grill. And in 7 minutes or so, you've got an amazing dish, and you're essentially getting out of the way, again, of the flavors of the protein, in this case being fish, but it is meat. And then I'm also a huge, huge fan, and we just made it last night, of grilled pork chops. There are so many great pork producers now here in the state. I mean, Iowa's got us hands down on the number, on the quantity, but we're really touching them right on the nose as far as the quality. And pigs that are raised very happy and have great, basically, a different type of pork marbling, and the cuts are just delicious. And again, 12 minutes in, It's browned. It's a little pink on the inside, and it's amazing. And all you need is a little rosemary. I did mine last night with some great diced up Zestar apples. And those apples we found actually on a shoot that we did last season. And you can squeeze the juices of the apple over the pork chops on the grill just like you would a lemon. And it gives this caramelization that is,
Are you getting another career, Kyle? Are you, do you need to tell me something? Or are you...
No.
Wow.
I finally have a family to cook for. And so this is what
I'm doing. And you're cooking. That is just like, what?
Yeah, but he's making huevos rancheros when he cooks. That's a little highbrow right over there. I have to tell you guys, Rob is getting a little excited when you're mentioning the apple on the pork. That sounds interesting. But Kyle, you said that the pigs are happy. And did you say the pigs are happy, so the marbling in the pork is different because the pigs are happy?
Yes, no question. The pigs are grazing essentially on grass, which is what they like to eat. Weeds, grass, all kinds of green things growing out of any sort of, side of a hill. They're not picky because they've got great grip with those hooves. And when they're done grazing, they can go and lay down in the shade, not necessarily in the mud. They get to move. They get to be athletic, which people don't think of pigs as being athletic. But if you think about how dangerous and athletic a boar is, a wild boar is, and that's, of course, what they're descended from, they are athletic in their own way. And so when these pigs get to essentially be themselves and eat what they were meant to eat, the marbling is dynamic, and the flavor is also incredible.
Interesting. So happy pigs, different flavor.
Yes,
what
no
about,
question.
Hey, Kyle, what about, I was just up at Pin Oak Lamb Farm over the weekend. From Sanford, Justin Abrahamian, got together with a chef, and these are people that we featured in the past, but they did this this great dinner on the farm featuring some really amazing Wisconsin lamb at Pin Oak Farms. And being someone that doesn't eat meat, but if you're taking, like, making those lollipop chops from, the rib of the, is that the rib, Kyle? Or
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's from,
Those are just like, you're basically putting those on the grill, and people are taking them off the grill and just eating them right then and there. They looked pretty amazing, but unfortunately there was no vegetarian wheat gluten version of that. Yeah.
But so. your listeners can take this to the bank from Arthur and I, who like to think we have our finger on somewhat of a foodie pulse. No, I think, in fact, many ways we do. Within a year or two, lamb belly will be as ascendant and as important as pork belly is on gastropub and other menus across the country. All of the really enlightened chefs are already using it, and they're starting to work lamb into their menus in really engaging, interesting ways. But it's the front of that cusp. And your listeners, I'm telling you,
you
can take
folks.
It to the bank.
You got it. That's the new trend.
Yeah.
All right, lamb belly. We heard it here. So, Arthur, as we get close to the end of the segment here, one more thing that you're excited about as a veggie griller.
As a veggie griller, one more thing I'm excited about. You know what I'm really excited about, and I have to be honest, is just seeing all the people come together and you know, no matter what their food preference is, their political preference, just seeing people come together and grill. I'm in Mineral Point right now, and I just went through a parade with a local cheesemaker, Andy Hatch, and his band. And just to see, like, all the people come together and celebrate this great day and come together over food and meat and great local beer and all sorts of great local cheese and products, that's what I'm most excited about.
Oh, well, you've given us lots of delicious ideas and things to think about and get inspired to grill when Rob and I get off work today. So thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us, guys.
Happy 4th of July to both of you.
Happy 4th. That was Arthur Ersink and Kyle Cherik of Wisconsin Foodie.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. There's more great conversations coming up.